I first read a book by Australian author Wayne McCauley earlier this year, around the time that that reality TV show MasterChef was all over the television and Associated Media. It was his third novel, The Cook, about a young teenager, Zach, troubled youth, gets the opportunity to go to a rurally isolated chef school where he learns all the skills required to function in the service industry of high-end fine dining, selecting produce, working in the kitchen, butchery. The school ends badly, but his dedication and skills earn him another chance, a job as the house cook for a wealthy Melbourne family with their own problems. That ends badly too. His books are surreal, satirical, savagely funny, somewhat appropriate perhaps in a week where the judges of the Man Booker Prize issued their shortlist, saying they were looking for more experimental books, the shock of the language shone in so many different ways. We're talking to Wayne, and when I talked to him earlier this week, I started by asking him if the stream of consciousness writing style that he uses in the book, with no commas, was a conscious experimental device or just the best way to capture the character's voice.
Experimental's a funny word, isn't it? Because really, what I'm writing with The Cook, the stream of consciousness, I mean, you know, high modernism is 100 years old, so in that sense, you might even say that I'm being almost historically conservative by using stream of consciousness language. So it's not a stylistic experiment for me, not by any means. The language has come from thinking about the character and trying to live inside the character, actually. I suppose that's really essentially where the language has come from. Remembering also that what I'm attempting is, you know, this kind of strange combination between spoken language and written. You know, it's not, though, as you mentioned, there is no significant punctuation. I mean, it's not written phonetically, and so this is written language. I'm trying to find some sense of stream of consciousness in the writing and not necessarily in the spoken voice.
It made me think at times, you mentioned the way it's not written phonetically, of Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, which is a post-apocalyptic novel from a few decades ago. And again, once you get into the rhythm of these things, it almost becomes natural and draws you into the world in a way that perhaps just normal sentences do not.
That aspect, I think, about that's the great innovations of early modernism and the sense of the musicality of language, certainly I'm aware of that. And this idea of being drawn in, I mean, I listen to music a lot and all kinds of music. And I know I had some... I had some strange idea in my head when I started this book of trying to kind of step into the river of a long piece of music that has its highs and lows and it you know sort of shifts and changes, and to try and, I guess, ultimately find that kind of fluidity in language that we find in, well, say, a great orchestral piece. But I actually listen to a lot of what's called post-rock and you know, sort of often simple volume changes even that kind of build to crescendos, and you know, the old sort of loud and quiet, loud and quiet, all those kinds of shifts. I mean, I like that kind of stuff, and as much as it's possible for language to imitate such a, in many ways, slippery and abstract thing as music, I think I was trying to do that in the sense of what you're talking about, drawing the reader in, that we come into music in a way. We have to leave our logic at the door, our critical faculties to some extent at the door, and get swept up in it. And that is exactly what I was looking for. That's what I wanted my reader to feel.
You've talked of the conservatism of the Australian literary culture when set against examples like contemporary music, visual arts, theatre, architecture. Australia, like Pākehā, New Zealand, a young culture, a couple of hundred years old. Are you surprised that it's still so rigid in many ways?
I'm gobsmacked in many ways. We're talking about white culture here in Australia is a little over 200 years old. And yet, this is a personal view. I think that at some point, I think it was sometime after the 1980s, when, in a sense, Australian culture, you know, with a capital G, announced itself, not just to Australians themselves, but the world stage, that there was some sense that that's it, we'd arrived, we'd sort of fixed it, we'd locked it down, it was all fine now, we didn't have to worry about it anymore. I find that notion ludicrous. And as a guy who is a little younger than that generation and kind of was you know, kind of in the slipstream of that generation. You know, I found such notions ludicrous that we could be speaking of, we could even be speaking in any sense of an Australian culture, you know, in terms of white culture, when our nation has barely been born. To come back to that word experiment, I feel like we're still, in many senses, in an experimental stage of our historical development, and I don't mean just artistically, and that, you know, the possibilities of young countries, and we are one, the possibilities of a young country is what interests me, not the idea that we need to have history and culture, we need it locked down in books, taught in schools, and that's that, and it's unquestionable. I find that notion quite absurd. So my belief as an artist, my feeling as an artist, is that everything's on the table, all possibilities are open, and I personally feel that literary culture has not taken advantage of that idea, and certainly whenever I speak to people younger than myself, I get a little bolshy about it, but I certainly encourage them to not think for one moment that they shouldn't be allowed to cut against the grain.
You started your career trying to get published in the 90s, and it's a time you describe as a dark chapter for the Australian industry, with economic rationalisation wreaking many wrenching changes on the traditional structure. Is that why you started with small independent publishing houses?
Well, it was inevitable. It was a fait accompli. Yep. I kind of had no choice. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's easy to rewrite history, isn't it? You know, I mean, but yes, I was rejected by all the big publishers in Australia. My early work was systematically and comprehensively not wanted. So I ended up in small indie publishing as a matter of course. And I think, but I mean, I understand that. I kind of understood it at the time, but I certainly understand it retrospectively. The publishing industry here had changed. It had become much more centralised, monopolised, and, you know, and ultimately the economic rationalism that was taking over all kinds of areas of culture and society at that time also took over publishing, and that, you know, risks weren't being taken. I mean, this was the time, of course, where poetry, for example, disappeared from the lists of mainstream publishing houses. I mean, I think poetry is the canary in the mine. You know, I think when you're not prepared to publish just, you know, two or three volumes of poetry per year, then there's definitely something wrong with the literary culture. Let alone, might I say, short stories, which I was writing at that time. Let alone collections of short stories, which also disappeared from the lists. And was always justified by the mantra that, you know, short story collections don't sell. Short story collections don't sell. If you say it often enough, you know, it becomes true. Because, of course, if you don't want to sell short story collections, well, naturally they won't sell. So that happened too. These areas of literary work, let alone anything more experimental, we might say, these areas of literary work kind of disappeared. And it's sort of a consolidation of what might be called Australian writing happened. So I found myself on the edges, on the fringes, on the margins of that, because I was working in a way that that seemed to be not of any interest to mainstream publishing. So my path through indie publishing was incredibly important. The small magazines played a huge part in that, and of course my first publisher was a very, very small, tiny, you know, cottage publisher, small print runs, and subsequently small sales. But of course, you know, all the time I was perfecting my craft, and I guess somehow out there finding some readers too.
But your first book, your first novel, Blueprints for a Barbed Wire Canoe, that was on Black Pepper, I think, and
got
into reprint and was widely acclaimed. And we were talking about schools before, ended up on the Victorian English curriculum, is that right?
Well, it did extraordinarily, not only to my surprise, but I'm sure many others. But, you know, I guess that was a really interesting case of this, of perceptions about what's experimental, what's outrageously risky, you know, and what's not. And extraordinarily, I mean, that book was considered perhaps something of an eccentric or idiosyncratic novel. It was published by a very, very tiny publisher. But the simple case was that it came out, it got some fantastic reviews. The people who select the reading lists for you know, Year 12 students here in Victoria got onto it, and they all loved it. They thought it was a work that they could teach, in the sense that it had layers of things to explore. And within the space of a year or so, the book was being read by thousands of students around the state. So, I mean, you know, I suppose empiric victories, if you want. But, you know, what it did indicate to me, and particularly as I went out to schools and spoke to these kids, that, you know, this was okay, you know, to the straight or the mainstream perspective, it was a, you know, an experimental book. But to these guys, it was just, you know, it was a great read. It had a lot in it to think about and talk about. And certainly, you know, through all of my work, I'm aware of my reader, and I hope I have never willingly given the bird to a reader and said, you know, I'm going to make this hard for you. I mean, you know, Blueprints, my first novel, was a cracking good read too.
And it
it's
is.
It's crazy. And, yeah, well, as idiosyncratic as it is, or as mad as the premise might be, you know, I think it's an easy book to read, essentially.
It's a kind of a dark fable about suburbia, far-flung suburbia connected by freeways and dreams all gone wrong, written long before the global financial crisis turned into what we have today. But I've been reading contemporary accounts, magazine accounts of housing estates in Florida and around the US that have been completely, you know, just abandoned by this by this crash that we've had. Is that what's happened in outer Melbourne, this terrible urban sprawl?
I feel like that whole area of our infrastructure, of our civic, you know, community is hanging on by its fingernails, I'd say. I don't think the situation is the same in the States. Melbourne in particular has had a massive boom in population. And, you know, and housing is critical. What's happened in major cities, and it's not only here, but I'm figuring around the world, and I guess there too, you know, is how the the renovation of the inner city has happened, and that, you know, what were once poor working class areas have become gentrified. The middle class has moved in. The prices have gone up. And so, you know, low income housing has been pushed out to the margins. And this, of course, you know, my book was actually written in the 1990s.
Yep.
But even then, you know, I certainly felt like it was a major issue. I came from not an outer suburban housing estate, but I came from myself from an outer suburb of Melbourne. This idea that people without the means tend to get marginalised. And by that, I mean in a geographic sense. And that's been happening in this country over many years in all the major cities. And I feel it is such a massive social problem that we are creating for ourselves. And here in Melbourne at the moment, it's accelerating at a rate of knots. And, you know, it's one thing to build, to offer, let's say, and certainly that's what a developer does, a beautiful house at a very low cost. And these houses are quite extraordinary, you know, three bedroom, upstairs, downstairs, entertainment rooms, and, you know, beautiful looking things until they start to crack and fall apart. You know, beautiful looking things to offer these, you know, this dream home for such a low price. I mean, of course, people are going to take them, but often these developments are being built, you know, way out of town. You know, some roads go in, some power poles go in, the blocks are carved up, the houses go up, and we have no public transport, we have no sort of social infrastructure, often shopping is a mile away. And, you know, the most important thing of all, of course, is that there is no employment. These suburbs create commuter communities, and I feel, you know, there's something wrong. I'm not saying I know how to fix it. I kind of wish I'd become an urban planner and not a writer. I wish I could fix it. I don't know what to do about it.
There's still time.
Thank you. Yes, maybe there is.
Mitcham, where you grew up, which was outer eastern suburbs of Melbourne, as you said, almost semi-rural, I think, at that time.
It was, yeah.
Your first job after school there was working in a market garden.
Yeah, ironically, a market garden that shortly after I stopped working there, of course, became a housing estate, as many, many, many market gardens have around the fringes of Melbourne, and I know that the imagery from working at that place in a number of ways has certainly informed my first book and has informed me, I guess, as a person too. But but the landscape of that, and by that I mean, as you said, you're absolutely right. I mean, I worked on a market garden in a place called Roeville, for those who want to look at it up on a map, which is even a little further out from my home suburb of Mitcham. And it was, as you say, semi-rural, but, you know, the houses, they were a-coming. And they were coming down the hill at a rapid rate of knots as I, you know, worked out on the paddocks alongside mostly Italian migrants, and picking Brussels sprouts and so on. And these houses, you know, literally for the years I worked on, I worked over a few years, the time I worked on that market garden, started coming down the hill. There was a hill above the farm, and they sort of crept over the top of the hill and started coming down. And I say it like that because it actually felt like that they were moving. You could see this kind of amoebic-like movement of the new housing estates. And I think that image has absolutely stuck with me. And it's interesting. The other day, I was going out to a birthday party, my niece's birthday party, at a place outside of Melbourne here, a zoo, an open range zoo, and a place called Werribee, where really the food bowl of Melbourne, where much of the remaining market garden is found. And as we turned off the freeway, I saw this market garden that because I used to work on one, they've got some cabbages in, you know, the cabbages are just in and the fixed sprinkler rows are on and all that. And as we drove past that farm the other day, I saw the for sale sign up on it because, of course, it would be one of the last remaining just in that area because that particular little plot of land is absolutely surrounded now. By housing estates, the back fences coming right up to the cabbages. And I think that speaks a lot about what's happening to our cities and, as I said, something that I'm, you know, constantly intrigued about.
I'm talking to Australian writer Wayne McCauley about his book, The Cook. For those people who are unfortunate enough not to have yet encountered The Cook, it's a insight into the world of sort of like a parallel world, I think, to MasterChef. And you started the book before the MasterChef phenomenon exploded. But have you watched those shows?
Well, I the first season of MasterChef started here in Australia when I was about two-thirds of the way through my first draft of The Cook. So it was fascinating, let me put it that way. And, of course, at that stage of the game, I was deeply into the book and deeply into the character's head and deeply into, as he was, learning as much as he possibly could about this fancy cuisine. So I found myself, I was a different kind of watcher to my partner and my daughter, perhaps, but, you know, I found myself plonked on the couch with them every evening watching it, but, of course, with a little notepad beside me, marking up some of the new ingredients I'd found and some of the new ways that they were using to prepare them.
Because you're not a cook. You're not a cook yourself.
No. I mean, I can cook spaghetti bolognese. Yes.
What about butchering a beast?
No, I've never done that. I'm not sure that I could. I mean, I'm a meat eater. I'm not saying that I'm a vegetarian. I'm not. I worked in a market garden, so I'm familiar with killing vegetables, but I don't think I could do that, no.
Because there's a lot of meat in The Cook, both metaphorically and literally.
There is, yeah. And of course, I guess that, you know, going back to the MasterChef thing, I guess that always for me it's about contrast. Always for me it's about what you see and what's beneath the image, I guess. You know, and those extraordinary moments on cooking shows like that, and not just that, because there are plenty of shows before that, the Jamie Olivers and, you know, so on. You know, this idea of sort of presenting an extraordinary little, piece of flesh, essentially, on a plate with all the garnishings and so on. And seeing how beautiful it is, and I'm sure, you know, how beautiful it must taste, mind you. But this strange disjunction that we have in our minds when we try then to scramble back from that image to the image of the animal in the abattoir. That's a difficult mind journey for us, isn't it? I find it is, and that it's somewhere in the distance between those two images that a lot of the ideas of the cook were born. And by that I mean that, you know, I remember another niece, a much older one than the one I went to the birthday party with. Say this was some time ago, but you know, she just didn't know where chickens came from, and you know, did think they came from a plastic packet in the supermarket, and was horrified when she realised, I think, you know, well into her late teens or early 20s, that chickens are those things that, you know, walk around with feathers and so on. And she became a vegetarian and has been ever since. I think it's an extraordinary story. But what's extraordinary about it is that we have a generation among us who could possibly even think like that, to whom that revelation could come. Is an extraordinary thing. So I'm of a slightly older generation, but I know that I'm not in contact with my food source. I know that it is a really big mind journey that I have to make to associate the, you know, the black plastic glad wrapped covered packet of chicken, you know, in the supermarket with the thing squawking out in the paddock. And then it's in that area that I guess the cook starts to dig.
And you've also said that you were thinking when you were writing The Cook about how the world turns to decadence to make itself feel better at times of great economic crisis, and it seems like, you know, we're just at the start of this.
I used that analogy only because we have historical examples, and I mean the Roman Empire is the most obvious, of course, but you know, I think that's certainly what got my mind thinking about this book in the first place, was the idea that what's going on here when the service industry is exploding, where this kind of restaurant cafe culture is exploding, where fine dining is becoming something that we all must do at least once a week, at the moment when really the world economy is going down the plug hole, and truth be known, that's the two things, you know, the planet, those two planets were aligning, and I'm talking back around 2008, 2009 when I started writing The Cook. What's going on? And of course, you know, as someone who has read a bit of history and thought a lot about society and culture, I couldn't help noticing that this seems to be something that recurs, that when things are bad, we eat, drink, and be merry, and I felt like maybe that's what is going on. Whether it's right or wrong or good or bad is beyond me to make a judgment, but this seemed to be what was happening.
That's Wayne McCauley, author of The Cook, my book of the year to date. His two earlier books, both originally published by small presses, have recently been reissued by Text Publishing. The debut, Blueprints for a Barbed Wire Canoe, a dark take on the Australian dream of getting a house in the suburbs, and a second, which we didn't talk about, Caravan Story, an unflinching look at the artist's position in a society where everything's for sale.